Slipping away, Jefferson found Betsy's room, where, her husband said, my wife was undressing or in bed. Jefferson failed again. He was repulsed with indignation and menaces of alarm and ran off, said John Walker. Decades later, Jefferson confirmed the Walker story. It had come to light after a political break between Jefferson and John Walker, who had learned in the intervening years of his friend's pursuit of his wife. It had been, Jefferson said, an incorrect thing to do. Frustrated by his failure with Mrs. Walker, Jefferson took solace in a glorious autumn of plays and politics in Williamsburg in 1768. Some years before, the Reverend Samuel Davies, a Presbyterian clergyman, had chastised Virginia for its love of drama, saying, plays and romances were more read than the history of the Blessed Jesus. Offerings in the capital in the spring had included Joseph Addison's Drummer, Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, John Gay's Beggar's Opera, and Thomas Otway's Venice Preserved and the Orphan. Now Jefferson watched performances by William Verling's Virginia Company of Comedians and of John Holmes's Douglas and Henry Carey's farce The Honest Yorkshireman. Meanwhile, Jefferson was playing the part of patron to the arts, bringing the Italian musician Francis Alberti from Williamsburg to Albemarle. Alberti taught Jefferson on the violin. The With Jefferson Circle lost its most powerful member when Francis Fouquier died at the Governor's Palace in March 1768. In his will, Fouquier expressed regret that his slaves would have to be sold after his death, and he took the then unusual step of allowing his dozen adult slaves to choose their new masters and stipulating that the women were not to be separated from their children. A man of the Enlightenment to the end, he also suggested that his body be autopsied should the cause of death be uncertain. His hope, he said in his will, was that he may become more useful to my fellow creatures by my death than I have been in my life. Fouquier's burial, 5 days later in the north aisle of Bruton Parish Church, not far from With's house, marked the end of an era for Jefferson, With, and the other Fouquier intimates at the palace, the guests who had enjoyed the royal governor's hospitality and listened with pleasure to Jefferson's performances on the violin in the big rooms, as well as the end of a period of temperate local imperial governance. In later years, Jefferson came to think of Fouquier as the ablest man who had ever filled that office. Norbourne Berkeley, 4th Baron Beauteture, popularly referred to as Lord Beauteture, succeeded Fouquier as governor, and he was determined to make himself pleasant. A family of Jefferson's friends were spending an evening singing on the steps of their Williamsburg house when they heard a passerby call out, "Charming, charming! Proceed, for God's sake, or I will go home directly." It was Beauteture, who happily joined them. The good cheer could not last. On the same day the Virginia Gazette reported Fouquier's death, the paper published the 8th installment of a series of farmers' letters by John Dickinson, a Pennsylvanian who argued that should London ignore American concerns, let us then take another step by withholding from Great Britain all the advantages she has been used to receive from us. Let us all be united with one spirit in one cause. With Fouquier dead, one world was beginning to end, and another was being born. At the same time Jefferson was creating chaos at Belvoir and living a cosmopolitan life in Williamsburg, he was building a new home for himself 2 miles, or less than half an hour's ride, from his mother's house. He named it Monticello, Italian for Little Mountain. On Monday, August 3rd, 1767, Jefferson noted the grafting of cherry trees on the property. On Sunday, May 15th, 1768, he reached an agreement to level 250 square feet on the top of the mountain at the northeast end by Christmas, in exchange for 180 bushels of wheat and 24 bushels of corn. 12 of those would not be due until the corn was harvested. If solid rock had to be dug, Jefferson noted in his garden book, then they would ask indifferent men to settle that part between us. Indifferent, in this context, meaning impartial. What is striking about Jefferson's attention to the possibility of hitting what he called solid rock is not that it might present insuperable obstacles, but that he was prepared to do whatever it took to have his way. He had decided to build there, and build he would. The Virginia Gazette of Thursday, December 15, 1768, reported Thomas Jefferson's election to represent Albemarle County in the House of Burgesses. He was 25 years old. He would serve with Dr. Thomas Walker, John Walker's father, and Betsy Walker's father-in-law. The campaign consisted largely of buying drinks and cakes for the landowners who had the suffrage. Over the next 41 years, Jefferson was rarely out of public office. Even without formal duties, he was never far from the contentions of his times. Since the Stamp Act debates and repeal, Parliament had, beginning in 1767, passed the Townshend Acts, taxes and duties named in honor of the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Charles Townshend. Massachusetts led the opposition for the colonies. In Boston in February 1768, the Massachusetts legislature approved a circular letter protesting the acts and calling on other colonies to follow suit. This was the political climate when the Burgesses first sat with Jefferson as a member on Monday, May 8, 1769. There was a sense of urgency in Williamsburg. London had ordered Beauchatour to dissolve the House if the Burgesses joined Massachusetts in protesting the Townshend Acts. Within days, Beauchatour had the opportunity to obey the imperial command. The colonial lawmakers had passed a resolution in support of Massachusetts. At noon, on Wednesday, May 17, 1769, therefore, Beauchatour summoned the Burgesses to the council chamber. "I have heard your resolves, and augur ill of their effect," Beauchatour told them. "You have made it my duty to dissolve you, and you are dissolved accordingly." Jefferson had been seated in the House for not quite 10 days. The very opening hours of his elective career, then, were suffused with conflict, crisis, and a creative search for a path forward that gave Americans, rather than distant authorities, control over their lives. With his colleagues, he left the council chamber and walked to the Apollo Room of the Raleigh Tavern, the same place where he had once stammered before Rebecca Burwell. As the Burgesses passed beneath the lead bust of Sir Walter Raleigh above the front door of the two-story tavern, they were, in the words of the Journal of the House, to decide which measures should be taken in their distressed situation for preserving the true and essential interests of the colony. By the next day, the Virginians had a plan. They would not import or consume anything from Great Britain. When Jefferson left Williamsburg after his inaugural session, he was already steeped in the politics of protest and of power. On Thursday, February 1st, 1770, Jefferson was playing his accustomed role as head of the family, accompanying his mother on a visit to a neighbor, when word of disaster reached them. Shadwell had burned. Jefferson was devastated. His first question to the slave who brought the news was whether his library had been rescued from the flames. "The books were all burned," the slave replied, adding, "But ah, we saved your fiddle." For a man who prized physical objects, he was to prove an inveterate collector, a tangible manifestation of his curious mind. The ash and the smoke and the ruins were especially galling and dispiriting. Fire was a reminder of those things, those many things, that lay beyond human control. Jefferson had spent almost a decade in the study and the practice of law, an undertaking based on the premise that men could, with some limitations, construct an order that enabled them to exert some power over the affairs of the world. The destruction of Shadwell was an example of how little control Jefferson, or any man, really had. Nearly everything was gone. The burned books amounted to £200, Jefferson guessed. But that did not bother him so much. "Would to God it had been the money. That would have never cost me a sigh," he wrote to John Page. The real pain came from the loss of his books and his legal papers, including notes he had prepared for his work as a lawyer during the coming court term. Without them, he was no longer master of the work at hand. He was desperate, even frantic, dispatching news of the fire and pleas for advice and reassurance. He contemplated moving from the neighborhood altogether, a remarkable thought for a man so engaged by his sense of place. Another measure of Jefferson's grief at the fire is that the loss of his notes evoked a speech of Prospero's in The Tempest, one of the landmark tragic set pieces in Shakespeare, whom Jefferson had first encountered in his father's now charred library. He bleakly alluded to it in the wake of the Shadwell disaster. Our revels now are ended. These our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And, like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. It was a time of testing for the young scholar and aspiring statesman. It was easy enough to read of tragedy and to explore it philosophically, turning over the problems of the spirit and the nature of things with glasses of wine in hand at warm hearths. The ability to apply what one thought in order to shape how one felt, however, was another more difficult thing. Thomas Jefferson had this ability. His head and his heart were contiguous regions of his character with open borders. Plenty of philosophical men live in abstract regions, debating types and shadows. The rarer sort is the reader and thinker who can see the world whole. In the ashes of Shadwell, Jefferson managed to do just that. He turned to the future, which to him meant Monticello. The summit of his mountain was now cleared. On the southeastern hillside he created an orchard of pears, apples, nectarines, pomegranates, and figs. "You bear your misfortune so becomingly," George Wythe wrote his pupil, "that as I am convinced you will surmount the difficulties it has plunged you into, so I foresee you will hereafter reap advantages from it several ways." Wythe added a tag from Virgil, "Durate, et vos met rebus servate secundis." The line means, "Carry on, and preserve yourselves for better times." In an advertisement Jefferson placed in the Virginia Gazette for a runaway slave in 1769, he wrote, "Runaway from the subscriber in Albemarle, a mulatto slave called Sandy, about 35 years of age, his stature is rather low, inclining to corpulence, and his complexion light. He is a shoemaker by trade, in which he uses his left hand principally, can do coarse carpenter's work, and is something of a horse jockey. He is greatly addicted to drink, and when drunk is insolent and disorderly. In his conversation he swears much, and his behavior is artful and knavish. He took with him a white horse much scarred with traces, of which it is expected he will endeavor to dispose. He also carried his shoemaker's tools, and will probably endeavor to get employment that way. Whoever conveys the said slave to me in Albemarle shall have 40 shillings reward if taken up within the county, 4 pounds if elsewhere within the colony, and 10 pounds if in any other colony, from Thomas Jefferson." From about this period until his death, according to the historian Lucius Stanton's research, Thomas Jefferson would own more than 600 slaves. He inherited 150 from his father and his father-in-law, and bought roughly 20. Most of the others were born into slavery on his lands. From 1774 to 1826, Jefferson tended to have about 200 slaves at any one time. The range ran from 165 to 225. When he served at the highest levels as a diplomat, as a member of George Washington's cabinet, as vice president, as president, and in his retirement at Monticello, as an American sage, Jefferson was to embody the slave-owning interest. In the beginning of his public career, though, Jefferson was more willing to work to reform slavery than he was to prove in later decades. In 1769, in the House of Burgesses, Jefferson recalled, "I made one effort in that body for the permission of the emancipation of slaves, which was rejected." Two words in Jefferson's recollection are key. He was making an effort for the permission of emancipation, not for the kind of broad emancipation that Abraham Lincoln would declare 9 decades later. For Jefferson, it was a question of power. In that first session, in 1769, he crafted a bill that shifted control of emancipation from the general court to slave owners themselves. The legislation would have given the individual Virginia slave owner the unilateral authority to free a slave. In his mind's eye, Jefferson envisioned a Virginia in which he and others like him were beyond the reach of the governor and council, who, under current law, decided requests for emancipation based on how they, not the planter, but the judges, chose to define meritorious services. Jefferson asked Richard Bland, a cousin, to take the lead on the legislation. The reaction from the House was swift and certain. Bland, Jefferson recalled, was treated with the grossest indecorum. Very shortly thereafter, Jefferson argued the case of Samuel Howell versus Wade Netherland. At issue was a matter of perennial concern to the planter class. To what extent were the descendants of mixed-race parents bound into servitude? Jefferson argued that his client, Samuel Howell, a grandson of a white woman and a black man, should be free, despite Virginia statutes that said he should be held in servitude until the age of 31. Jefferson took the occasion to make a natural law argument, writing that everyone comes into the world with a right to his own person and using it at his own will, Jefferson said. This is what is called personal liberty, and is given him by the author of nature, because it is necessary for his own sustenance. He lost the case. At different moments in his legislative and public life, Jefferson said things or proposed courses of action that could conceivably have led to the end of a slave society. The Howell brief suggests a Jeffersonian openness to such an eventuality. But for him, abolition was always to be an eventuality for future generations, not a reality that he would ever see. The reaction to the Bland bill and of the court in Howell could not have failed to leave an impression, too, on the young lawyer-legislator so anxious for popularity. Wounded by the defeats of his progressive efforts on slavery, Jefferson was finally to retreat to a more conventional position. Jefferson sought refuge from the anxieties of the Shadwell fire, the toll of trial work, and the capturing of runaways in a familiar pastime, flirting. I reflect often with pleasure on the philosophical evenings I passed at Rosewell in my last visits there, Jefferson wrote in a section of a letter addressed to his friend and classmate John Page's wife. I was always fond of philosophy, even in its drier forms. But from a ruby lip it comes with charms irresistible. Writing about another friend in love, Jefferson said, I do not mean, madam, to advise him against it. On the contrary, I am become an advocate for the passion, for I too am coelo tactus. The last Latin phrase translates as struck by. Jefferson, it seemed, was also in love. Chapter 5. A World of Desire and Denial. Harmony in the marriage state is the very first object to be aimed at. Thomas Jefferson. The woman in question was a rich widow, accomplished and intelligent, with what family tradition held to be a lithe and exquisitely formed figure. Martha Wales Skelton had been born at a plantation called The Forest in Charles City County, Virginia, in 1748. She was 5.5 years younger than Jefferson. Known to intimates as Patty, she was beautiful, musical, and well-read, and Jefferson adored her. She was said to be striking-looking. Her complexion was brilliant. Her large, expressive eyes of the richest shade of hazel, her luxuriant hair of the finest tinge of auburn, Henry Randall wrote after interviewing her descendants. She was, a contemporary said, a woman of good sense and good nature. Patty and Thomas shared tastes in literature and in wide-ranging conversation. One kinsman thought the Jeffersons a couple well calculated and disposed to communicate knowledge and pleasure. Patty taught her children and her nieces and nephews what tradition calls the beginnings of knowledge, suggesting an interest in education similar to Jefferson's. In her, Jefferson found the most congenial of companions, a woman who spoke his language. Their nights were filled with music and wine and talk, talk of everything. They seemed to have fully shared their lives with each other. He confided in her about politics. A granddaughter recalled Patty's passionate attachment to Jefferson and her exalted opinion of him. For his part, Jefferson's conduct as a husband had been admirable in its ensemble, charming in its detail. Patty once complained that some instance of Jefferson's generosity had gone unappreciated by its recipient. But it was always so with him, Mrs. Jefferson is said to have remarked. He is so good himself that he cannot understand how bad other people may be. Smart and strong-willed, Patty liked having her way. She was insistent on discipline. Jefferson once gently rebuked her for reminding their eldest daughter, Patsy, of an old childhood crime. "My dear, a fault in so young a child, once punished, should be forgotten," Jefferson said to Patty. Patsy recalled feeling a warm gush of gratitude for her father's support. Patty was not a woman of retiring nature or of quiet views. She had a mind of her own and could be assertive and acerbic. My grandmother Jefferson had a vivacity of temper which might sometimes border on tartness, but which, in her intercourse with her husband, was completely subdued by her exceeding affection for him, said Ellen Randolph Coolidge, a Jefferson granddaughter. Perhaps not always, however. Jefferson may have been speaking from marital experience when he advised a daughter, "Much better if our companion views a thing in a different light from what we do, to leave him in quiet possession of his view. What is the use of rectifying him if the thing be unimportant? And if important, let it pass for the present and wait a softer moment and more conciliatory occasion of revising the subject together." Yet Patty could reassure and calm her husband, who was given to worry and restlessness. Easing Thomas Jefferson's emotional tensions was a difficult task. He was acutely sensitive. At first blush, the fact that such a man was drawn to politics, where approval is fleeting and criticism constant, may seem contradictory. The connection between Jefferson's interior and exterior lives, however, follows a familiar pattern found in politicians from age to age. Ambition creates a hunger for action and acclaim, and those who crave applause have a particular aversion to criticism. His wife appears to have been one of the few people who could soothe him. Patty Wales Jefferson was the daughter of a man who had risen far in Virginia. Born to a poor, undistinguished family in Lancaster, England, John Wales made his fortune in America as a lawyer, debt collector, slave trader, and planter. John Wales's first wife, Martha Epps, was the daughter of Francis Epps of the Bermuda Hundred Plantation. They had married in 1746. In the autumn of 1748, a daughter named Martha, called Patty, was born. The child lived, but the mother did not. John Wales married twice more, producing four other daughters, three of whom survived. Patty Wales grew up, then, in an uncertain household. She never knew her own mother, and two stepmothers came and went. Her experience with her father's wives was unhappy enough that she never wanted her own children to face the possibility of having a stepmother. On her deathbed, she reportedly extracted a promise from Jefferson never to marry again. From the loss of her mother to the shifting cast of characters in the domestic life of the forest, Patty learned early that the world was perilous and changeable. Her father's livelihood partly depended on precariousness in the lives of others. As what was called an agent for Farrell and Jones, a British merchant house, John Wales was a debt collector, a detail Jefferson neglected to mention in his description of his father-in-law in his autobiography. Mr. Wales was a lawyer of much practice, to which he was introduced more by his great industry, punctuality, and practical readiness, than to eminence in the science of his profession, Jefferson wrote of his father-in-law. He was a most agreeable companion, full of pleasantry and good humor, and welcomed in every society. There are notes of both condescension and insecurity in Jefferson's account of his father-in-law. The assessment of Wales's legal career is that of a much more learned lawyer, as Jefferson was. More interesting still is the phrase, "welcomed into every society." Why assert a man's inclusion in social circles unless exclusion was a threat or even an occasional reality? The point accomplishes the opposite of what Jefferson intended, for it raises the question of Wales's standing in colonial society. That standing was at risk in the circles in which Jefferson moved, for Wales embodied one of the two worst fears of any planter. If slave insurrections ranked first, being made to pay one's usually enormous debts was a near second. The sight of Wales coming into view provoked anxiety among the planters, many of whom appear to have taken steps to avoid his collection calls. A mocking poem in the Virginia Gazette of Thursday, January 1, 1767, refers to John Wales as ill-bred. The context of the remark was a controversial murder trial in Williamsburg. Wales, who was representing the accused, had been charged with lying in a deposition. That Patty's father was not a man as established as, say, a Randolph, suggests there was more love than calculation in Jefferson's decision to take his chances with the man's daughter. Jefferson undertook legal work for Wales beginning in 1768. 2 years before, in November 1766, Patty, who had just turned 18, married Bathurst Skelton. She bore him a son, John, a year later. Patty lost her husband in September 1768, and their son, John, died in the summer of 1771. The bereaved Mrs. Skelton had returned to the forest, her father's house, where, as an attractive widow, she had no want of company. Suitors lurked about, hoping they might succeed the late Mr. Skelton. Patty Wales Skelton was, taken on her own, immensely appealing to a man like Jefferson. He was her elder, but she had seen and experienced much. There would have been little frivolity in her manner. No coquette, she had more in common with Betsy Walker than with Rebecca Burwell. Patty was a woman who had lost her mother, her husband, her son, and who understood what it took to run complex households. One of the chief complexities of domestic life on Virginia's plantations, a complexity Patty knew well, lay in negotiating the questions of blood, sex, and dominion that bound white and enslaved families in largely unspoken ways. The forest was rife with such issues. Around 1735, a man named Hemmings, the white English captain of a trading ship, fathered a daughter with a full-blooded African woman. The African woman's child was named Elizabeth, also known as Betty. The details come from the account of Madison Hemmings, a great-grandson of Captain Hemmings and of the African woman. Mother and daughter ended up as slaves of the Epps family of Bermuda Hundred, the Epps family from which John Wales would take his first bride, Martha, who died in childbirth. By 1746, the year Wales married Martha Epps, Elizabeth Hemmings, then about 11 years old, moved to the forest. There, beginning at age 18, she gave birth to several children. Wales, meanwhile, outlived his daughter's two stepmothers. After the third Mrs. Wales died in February 1761, Elizabeth Hemmings, now about 26 years old, was taken by the widower Wales as his concubine, said Madison Hemmings. Beginning in 1762, Elizabeth Hemmings bore five children to Thomas Jefferson's father-in-law, Robert, James, Thenia, Critta, and Peter. In 1773 came a sixth, Sarah, who was to be known by the nickname Sally. Such arrangements were not uncommon in slave-owning states. In the 19th century, South Carolinian Mary Boykin Chestnut noted something about white women that was equally true in the 18th. Any lady is able to tell who is the father of all the mulatto children in everybody's household but their own. Those, she seems to think, drop from the clouds. It was a world of desire and denial. Sex across the color line, sex between owner and property, was pervasive, yet rarely directly addressed or alluded to. The strange intermingling of blood and affection and silence suffused the world of the forest that Jefferson came to know in 1770, the year he turned up as one of the candidates for Patty's hand. It was to suffuse Monticello, too, in the fullness of time. Jefferson's success in wooing the widow Skelton was not assured, which may have made him work all the harder. By the first months of 1771, Jefferson was in full pursuit. He wrote a romantic, poetical description of her to a correspondent in Williamsburg named Mrs. Drummond, an elderly woman who was friendly with the George Wythes. "No pen but yours could surely so beautifully describe, Patty," wrote Mrs. Drummond, who praised Jefferson's now lost Miltonic lines, and said she did not know whether Patty's heart was engaged already. How to capture her? Music was one means, books another. In family lore, Jefferson and Patty were destined for each other. A pair of competing suitors once arrived at the forest, where they heard Patty and Jefferson playing and singing beautifully together. Looking at each other, the two callers were said to have recognized the inevitable and departed without announcing themselves. As always, music was Jefferson's ally. To him, singing or the playing of the violin or the pianoforte was more than entertainment, more than the means of passing the hours when time grew heavy. Music, rather, offered a window into a man's soul, or into a woman's. In his literary commonplace book, Jefferson transcribed these lines from Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. "The man who has not music in his soul, or is not touched with concord of sweet sounds, is fit for treason, stratagems, and spoils. The motions of his mind are dull as night, and his affections dark as Erebus. Let no such man be trusted." Jefferson's mind was considering the defining human themes, always returning to the central question of politics. How is a man, as an intrinsically social animal, to live in relative peace and charity with his neighbors in a world given to passion and conflict? There was no single answer, only the enduring effort to bring clashing elements into harmony, and perhaps the most significant decision a man could make in fighting this lifelong battle was whom to marry. Jefferson needed a woman who shared his passion for music and all that music represented: sophistication, transcendence, and the life of the imagination and the heart, as well as that of flesh and blood. Patty Wales Skelton was such a woman. Jefferson was determined to have her, and to give her the best of everything. He was even briefly interested in his own aristocratic heritage in the old world. "I have what I have been told were the family arms, but on what authority I know not," Jefferson wrote his English agent, Thomas Adams. "It is possible there may be none. If so, I would with your assistance become a purchaser, having Sterne's word for it that a coat of arms may be purchased as cheap as any other coat." He usually affected an air of indifference about his mother's ancestry, and with the allusion to the novelist Lawrence Sterne's dismissive remark about heraldry, managed to poke fun at his own request, even as he was making it. Yet the inquiry was a sign of curiosity, if nothing else. Jefferson was more interested in buying his bride larger things. He ordered a clavichord from Hamburg, he said, because they are better made there and much cheaper, but soon fell in love with a pianoforte that he had to have. He was, he told his British agent, charmed by the pianoforte, and he canceled the clavichord request. The pianoforte was the thing, and he wanted it right away. "Let the case be of fine mahogany, solid, not veneered. The compass, from double G to F in alt, and plenty of spare strings, and the workmanship of the whole very handsome and worthy of the acceptance of a lady for whom I intended." He also needed a half dozen white silk cotton stockings, and a very particular umbrella, large, with brass ribs covered with green silk, and neatly finished. But the instrument was crucial. He was, he said, very impatient to have it by October. If it made it, it would be just in time for the wedding. Thomas Jefferson married Martha Wales Skelton on New Year's Day, 1772. He was 28. She was 23. It was a winter Wednesday. The Anglican ceremony, conducted by the Reverend William Coutts, was held at her father's house, and the celebrations ran for several days. Jefferson paid the clergyman £5 and tipped Elizabeth Hemings, Sally's mother's first appearance in his account books. On January 2nd, the Virginia Gazette reported the marriage. "Thomas Jefferson, Esquire, one of the representatives for Albemarle, to Mrs. Martha Skelton, relict of Mr. Bathurst Skelton." The Skelton connection was not something Jefferson thought much about. Captivated by visions of their new life together, He had unconsciously edited Patty's first husband out of the picture in his preparations for the wedding. In his bond for a marriage license, dated December 30, 1771, Jefferson mistakenly referred to her as a spinster. On the document, another hand crossed it out and inserted, widow. Her widowhood is more than an incidental detail. Though younger, Patty already knew more of marriage and its consolations and demands than Jefferson did, a fact that may have given her more confidence in herself as she embarked on a new life. In the depths of the first weeks of the snowy winter of 1772, Jefferson was a satisfied man. Given his wife's numerous pregnancies in the following years, there was no shortage of physical passion between them. Their first child, Martha, nicknamed Patsy, was born at 1 o'clock in the morning of Sunday, September 27, 1772, 9 months and 26 days after the marriage at the Forest. After their wedding, the Jeffersons remained at the Forest for some days before setting out for Monticello through the ever-worsening snowy weather. As they approached Shadwell and Monticello, the snow had grown too deep for their phaeton to continue. He and Patty then got on horseback and pressed on through the forests and the wind and the snow and the ice, and, as the shadows lengthened, through the gathering darkness. At sunset, they began their ascent, slowly and miserably taking the mountain's 867 feet. The trees along the path up to Monticello were likely weighed down by ice and snow. The Jeffersons may have had to pass through thickets of frozen branches hanging low across the trail. When they arrived, they found themselves on a lonely mountaintop, cold and unexpected. The fires were out and the slaves were elsewhere. The horrible dreariness of such a house, at the end of such a journey, I have often heard both relate, said their daughter, Patsy. The Jeffersons discovered part of a bottle of wine, and the night was, according to tradition, lit up with song and merriment and laughter. After a week or so, they moved on to Elk Hill, a plantation in Goochland County along the James River and Bird Creek. Elk Hill belonged to Patty. She had lived there with her first husband, and the Jeffersons made much use of the house and the land. At its peak, Elk Hill was 669 acres. A subject of particular interest in their private hours was James Macpherson's popular translation of the poetry of Ossian, said to be a third-century legendary Celtic bard. He was not. The poems were, in fact, written largely by Macpherson and passed off as ancient verse. The tender and the sublime emotions of the mind were never before so finely wrought up by human hand, Jefferson said in 1773. I am not ashamed to own that I think this rude bard of the North the greatest poet that has ever existed. Monticello is often seen as Jefferson's retreat from the world. He himself spoke of it in such terms. The house on the hill was also an imaginative redoubt, a fortress in which the master could not only seek shelter, but also gather himself and his forces to fight great battles. He may well have found in Ossian's epic imagery a poetic model for what he wanted his own world to be like. In his commonplace book, he copied a section that spoke to height and power and fame and adventure. As two dark streams from high rocks meet and mix and roar on the plain, loud, rough, and dark in battle meet Lochlin and Innisfoil. Chief mixed his strokes with chief and man with man. Steel clanging sounded on steel, helmets are cleft on high, blood bursts and smokes around. Strings murmur on the polished yews, darts rush along the sky, spears fall like the circles of light that gild the stormy face of the night. As the troubled noise of the ocean, when roll the waves on high, as the last peal of the thunder of heaven, such is the noise of the battle. For many were the falls of the heroes, and wide poured the blood of the valiant. Patty Jefferson was a careful housekeeper, taking steps to ensure that her husband's private world ran smoothly. She saw to fresh supplies of meat, eggs, butter, and fruit, and supervised the making of beer and of soap. She personally directed the work of the kitchen on more sophisticated foods. Mrs. Jefferson would come out there with a cookery book in her hand and read out of it to Isaac's mother how to make cakes, tarts, and so on, recalled Isaac Granger Jefferson, a slave who left a memoir of life at Monticello among the Jeffersons. A caller at Monticello, a German officer, found the Jeffersons charming and engaging. He admired Jefferson's copious and well-chosen library, and the Monticello project itself, saluting his host's noble spirit of building. He also noted that Jefferson was designing a compass for the parlor ceiling to track the strength and direction of the wind. What the Jeffersons did together made perhaps the greatest impression. As all Virginians are fond of music, he is particularly so, the visitor said. You will find in his house an elegant harpsichord pianoforte and some violins. The latter he performs well upon himself. The former his lady touches very skillfully, and who is, in all respects, a very agreeable, sensible, and accomplished lady. It is a warm portrait of a harmonious and happy life on the little mountain, a life of ideas, invention, and the making of music. It was the life Jefferson had long hoped for, the kind of life his father had built and his mother had maintained, and which he now gave his own family at his chosen summit. On Sunday, May 16, 1773, in a keen personal loss for Jefferson, his friend and brother-in-law, Dabney Carr, died of a bilious fever, leaving Jefferson's sister Martha to raise six children. Jefferson's instinctive reaction was that of a father. He did whatever was within his power to bring stability to his sister's family by offering order, shelter, and love in the midst of his own sadness over losing the beloved friend of his youth. His grief seemed to have surpassed that of his reaction to his sister Jane's death. For Carr, whom he buried at Monticello, he could not at first settle on a single epitaph, sketching out his plans for his friend's grave on a sheet of paper. Inscription on my friend D. Carr's tomb. Lamented shade, whom every gift of heaven profusely blessed, a temper winning mild, nor pity softer, nor was truth more bright. Constant in doing well, he neither sought nor shunned applause, no bashful merit sighed, near him neglected. Sympathizing, he wiped off the tear from sorrow's clouded eye with kindly hand, and taught her heart to smile. Mallet's Excursion. Send for a plate of copper to be nailed on the tree at the foot of his grave, with this inscription. Still shall thy grave with rising flowers be dressed, and the green turf lie lightly on thy breast. There shall the morn her earliest tears bestow, there the first roses of the year shall blow, while angels with their silver wings o'ershade the ground now sacred by thy relics made. On the upper part of the stone inscribe as follows. Here lie the remains of Dabney Carr, son of John and Jane Carr of Louisa County, who was born 1744. Intermarried with Martha Jefferson, daughter of Peter and Jane Jefferson, 1765, and died at Charlottesville, May 16, 1773, leaving six small children. To his virtue, good sense, learning, and friendship, this stone is dedicated by Thomas Jefferson, who of all men living, loved him most. While Jefferson struggled to absorb Carr's loss, Patty mourned her father. On Friday, May 28, 1773, John Wales died, leaving a heavily indebted estate. Patty Jefferson did not hesitate to move Elizabeth Hemings and the Hemings-Wales children, Patty's half-siblings, from the forest to Monticello in the wake of her father's death. We do not know how Patty really felt about her father's liaison with Elizabeth Hemings and about their children. Within the limitations of the world in which she lived, however, we do know that Patty chose to protect the Hemings family by keeping them together after Wales' death, and by bringing them into the domestic sphere she shared with her husband and child. The Hemings family was to be forever intertwined with the Jeffersons and with Monticello. Elizabeth Hemings' son, Robert, whom Jefferson called Bob, replaced Jupiter as Jefferson's body servant until Jefferson left for France in the 1780s. Elizabeth's son, James Hemings, traveled with him to Paris and worked as Jefferson's chef. Another son, John Hemings, often spelled with two M's, became an accomplished joiner and cabinet maker, crafting furniture, interior moldings, and a landau four-wheeled carriage of Jefferson's design. Jefferson now had charge over three branches of his or his wife's family. There was his own wife, Patty, and their infant daughter. There was his sister and his nieces and nephews. And in a connection no one could acknowledge, there was his wife's father's concubine, Elizabeth Hemings, and his wife's half-siblings, including Sally Hemings. One man, Thomas Jefferson, stood at the center of this eclectic universe. He was the master of Monticello, a Burgess of Virginia, a lawyer of note, and he was about to become a central leader and defining voice of a revolutionary nation in armed rebellion against the world's greatest empire. Part 2. The Revolutionary. Spring 1774 to Summer 1776. The Americans have made a discovery, or think they have made one, that we mean to oppress them. We have made a discovery, or think we have made one, that they intend to rise in rebellion. We know not how to advance. They know not how to retreat. The British statesman Edmund Burke. Chapter 6. Like a Shock of Electricity. Things seem to be hurrying to an alarming crisis, and demand the speedy, united counsels of all those who have a regard for the common cause. Letter of the Virginia House of Burgesses, May 31, 1774. It was a bizarre season at Monticello. In the early afternoon hours of Monday, February 21, 1774, the first recorded earthquake in the history of Virginia struck with strength in Albemarle County. In the furor, Elizabeth Jefferson, Thomas's reputedly mentally disabled sister, disappeared from Shadwell. She was found dead 3 days later, after apparently drowning in the Rivanna. In the middle of the first week of May, a springtime snowstorm left the Blue Ridge covered in white. The next day brought a terrible frost that killed almost everything, Jefferson said. Leaves, vines, wheat, rye, corn, and a good deal of tobacco. This frost was general and equally destructive through the whole country and the neighboring colonies, Jefferson wrote in his garden book. Only half of Monticello's fruit survived. Yet there was also joy on Jefferson's mountain. Patty Jefferson gave birth to a second daughter on Sunday, April 3, 1774. Called Jane Jefferson, the baby bore the name of both Jefferson's mother and of his late sister. It was Patty Jefferson's second delivery in 19 months. She had been pregnant for all but about 9 or so months of her 27-month-old marriage. Even among the elite, childbirth was dangerous and could be fatal to both mother and infant. Jefferson was to learn this well. All but 2 of the 6 children born to Patty and Thomas Jefferson were fated to die in infancy or childhood. Self-evidently an ardent lover, Jefferson also proved an attentive husband and father. His memorandum book notes the purchase of breast pipes, glass devices that facilitated the breastfeeding of infants. Political duty, however, always called. The House of Burgesses was set to meet in Williamsburg in the spring of 1774. There was much to discuss, and Jefferson had to be there. Leaving his wife and his 2 infant daughters, the newborn Jane and the toddler Patsy, Jefferson reached Williamsburg on the eve of confrontation with Britain. These had been and would continue to be years of crisis. Beginning in his first session as a member of the House of Burgesses in May 1769, Jefferson had served in the midst of conflict with Britain of varying degrees of severity. A pattern took hold. The British Parliament imposed new taxes to raise revenue from British America. Colonists in their sundry capitals, Boston, Annapolis, Philadelphia, Williamsburg, and so on, resisted to a greater or lesser degree, depending on the moment. The royal governments in the New World and the establishment in Britain grew yet more impatient with what they saw as a continent populated by the recalcitrant, the unreasonable, and the ungrateful. From the time of the Townshend Acts to the Boston Tea Party, a protest over duties on tea, London attempted to exert control. The American colonists fought back by various means. There were non-importation agreements in the colonies to keep British goods off the American market. There were objections to the possible arrest of Americans who would then be tried in England. There were committees of correspondence to establish communication among the colonies. In Virginia, Thomas Jefferson sensed a sort of tragic stasis. Independence was a possibility, but not a certain one. As late as May 1772, for example, George Wythe was still committed to the maintenance of at least the appearance of the status quo. Writing to London, he ordered, "A robe such as is worn by the clerk of the House of Commons, but better than the one I had before," which indeed was scandalous. Even allowing for irony in his manner of expression, Wythe clearly did not yet envision a new world of republican simplicity. A remark of Jefferson's father-in-law's illuminated the ethos of the time for many of the colonists. Writing in Williamsburg in October 1772, John Wales had reported, "Our sale of slaves goes on slowly, so 'tis uncertain when we shall be down, but I suppose before the rebel party leaves town." The rebel party was still only a movement to be alluded to in passing. To protest was one thing, to rebel quite another. There were Virginians of Jefferson's class who chose to remain loyal to London rather than take the path of revolution. Jefferson's cousin John Randolph of Tazewell Hall was to become known as John Randolph the Tory for his allegiance to the crown, an allegiance that led him to return to England as revolutionary sentiment grew. Overall, about a fifth of white American colonists in these years, or 20%, sided with England. Still, a notation in Jefferson's memorandum book suggests his own musings were more expansive. Non solum nobis, sed patriae. Not for ourselves only, but for our country. For the elite, revolution was the shrewdest economic choice. London had already stymied land ownership in the West, restricting those with capital, or those capable of borrowing capital, from acquiring coveted acres. Virginia's public finances were a mess. There was no way for the colony to honor the paper money issued during the Seven Years' War, which alienated most of the holders of the paper. And there was the inescapably personal issue of the money that planters owed creditors in Britain. In Jefferson's words, such debts were now hereditary from father to son for many generations, so that the planters were a species of property annexed to certain mercantile houses in London. Virginians owed at least £2.3 million to British merchants, nearly half the total owed by all the American colonies. In May 1774, Jefferson and Patrick Henry had proposed suspending payments of such debts. Only weeks earlier, Jefferson had made a personal financial decision with perilous consequences. When John Wales died in 1773, he left an estate worth £30,000, but one that was also heavily indebted, with £11,000 owed to his largest creditor, Farrell and Jones, in Bristol. In January 1774, Jefferson and Wales' two other sons-in-law decided to break up the jointly held estate among themselves, with a fateful result. Jefferson's liability for his portion of the Wales debt now extended to his personal property. For the colonists, the decision to revolt was not solely economic, but it was surely informed by concerns over money. In Virginia, the impetus to rebel came from the propertied elements of society. The middle and lower classes were slower to follow the lead of men such as Jefferson. It was a rich man's revolution, and Jefferson was a rich man. It was a philosophical revolution, and Jefferson was a philosophical man. The intersection of economic and ideological forces created a climate in which well-off, educated Virginians saw a clearer, more compelling, and more attractive future if they could successfully separate themselves from London. In Jefferson's political imagination, any move that could be interpreted as an encroachment on liberty was interpreted in just that way. Taxes, the presence of British troops, trade regulations, the disposition of Western lands and relations with Indian tribes, among other matters, were all seen as grasps for power by London, power that Jefferson and others believed rightly belonged to them, or at least to them within a constitution in which they played a much larger role. Absolutism was always just a step away, subjugation an imminent possibility. The Americans were not wrong to think this way, for the history they knew and the politics they were experiencing tended to favor the crown and its adherents rather than the people, as more broadly defined. As a Virginian and a Burgess, Jefferson had an acute sense of the tightening of royal authority. Before 1729, no royal governor in Virginia had suspended an act of the colonial legislature. In the ensuing 35 years, until 1764, Governors intervened fewer than 60 times, or less than twice a year. Then, in the 9 years between 1764 and 1773, there were 75 such suspensions, a steady and infuriating rate of increase that the most powerful Virginians, those in the House of Burgesses, felt directly and ever more often. On Thursday, May 19, 1774, Virginia newspapers announced the Boston Port Act. Enacted by Parliament, the law closed the city's port until restitution was made for the losses incurred by the East India Company in the Boston Tea Party the previous December. The legislation infuriated Jefferson's circle. It was one of what became known as the Intolerable Acts of 1774. Jefferson said he was among the Burgesses who agreed, "We must boldly take an unequivocal stand in the line with Massachusetts." Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, and four or five other members joined Jefferson in the Capitol's Council Chamber, home to a library of parliamentary and legislative precedents that included documents edited by John Rushworth, an anti-monarchical historian who had fought in the English Civil War. "We were under the conviction of the necessity of arousing our people from the lethargy into which they had fallen as to passing events," Jefferson recalled, "and thought that the appointment of a day of general fasting and prayer would be most likely to call up and alarm their attention." The Day of Fasting and Prayer resolution of Tuesday, May 24, 1774, was one in a series of lessons in the politics of revolution that from the unreasonably frosty May of 1774 through June and July of 1776 offered Jefferson opportunities to manage and marshal the American mind. He had learned the art of pragmatism during the Stamp Act debates, watching more experienced lawmakers find ways to exert their will against that of Patrick Henry. Now Jefferson turned his attention from the chambers of Williamsburg to the broad countryside, from the mechanics of legislation to the leadership of a mass movement. Jefferson's role in the adoption and promotion of the Day of Fasting and Prayer resolution illustrated his growing understanding of the importance of engaging the emotions of one's followers. For Jefferson, the decision to base a revolutionary appeal on religious grounds was expedient, reflecting more an understanding of politics than a belief that the Lord God of Hosts was about to intervene in British America. Though not a conventional Christian, Jefferson appreciated the power of spiritual appeals. To frame an anti-British argument in the language of faith took the rhetorical fight to the enemy in a way that was difficult to combat. Jefferson and his colleagues could argue that they were only humbling themselves before the Lord, calling on a largely religious populace to fast and pray, not to resist authority. The wording itself came after Jefferson and his comrades rummaged through Rushworth's collection of revolutionary precedents and forms of the Puritans of that day. In Jefferson's telling, his group cooked up a resolution on Monday, May 23, 1774. It asked Virginians to pray for deliverance from the evils of civil war. The House of Burgesses, meanwhile, considered joining a full boycott of all British goods and supporting calls for a Continental Congress. Reading the messages from the North and feeling the anxiety in the city, the colonial leadership in Williamsburg was aware of the stakes. A reckoning could not be far off. Monticello's cherries had ripened in the interval between Jefferson's departure for Williamsburg in May and his return to Albemarle County by July. He was home to do business. In a letter to their constituents, he and John Walker announced the Day of Fasting and Prayer, a reaction, they wrote, to the dangers impending over British America from the hostile invasion of a sister colony. Their language was martial and grave. Echoing the Burgesses' resolution, he and Walker argued there was a threat of civil war. To execute this strategy, Jefferson turned to his friend, the Reverend Charles Clay, the clergyman who had buried Jefferson's sister Elizabeth after she drowned earlier in the year. Clay was to preach the sermon in the parish of St. Anne's in the New Church on the Hardware River. The location itself was chosen to make the greatest impression, for it was the place thought the most centrical to the parishioners in general. Services were held on different days in different counties. The St. Anne's ceremony fell on Saturday, July 23, 1774. Jefferson was struck by the human element of the experience, writing, The people met generally with anxiety and alarm in their countenances, and the effect of the daze through the whole colony was like a shock of electricity, arousing every man and placing him erect and solidly on his center. 3 days later, the freeholders of Albemarle gathered at the courthouse in Charlottesville to elect Jefferson and Walker to the special August meeting in Williamsburg. The voters also adopted the resolutions of the freeholders of Albemarle County that denounced the Boston Port Act. Composed by Jefferson, the resolutions spoke of the common rights of mankind, promising, "We will ever be ready to join with our fellow subjects in exerting all those rightful powers which God has given us for the reestablishing and guaranteeing such their constitutional rights, when, where, and by whomsoever invaded." They called for an immediate ban on British imports and set a more distant date, October 1, 1775, 15 months away, for an end to exports, unless American grievances were redressed. At Monticello, working fast, enjoying fresh cucumbers and lettuce, Jefferson hurried to compose instructions to the delegates who were to attend the larger National Continental Congress, scheduled for September 5, 1774, in Philadelphia. Entitled "A Summary View of the Rights of British America," Jefferson's midsummer work was his first substantial state paper. With these pages, the instructions ran roughly 6,700 words, he invested the American cause with universal themes, linking the claims of the New World with the Whig story of the March of Liberty in the Old. He was writing, he said, to remind George III that our ancestors, before their emigration to America, were the free inhabitants of the British dominions in Europe, and possessed a right which nature has given to all men, of departing from the country in which chance, not choice, has placed them. That their Saxon ancestors had, under this universal law, in like manner left their native wilds and woods in the north of Europe, had possessed themselves of the island of Britain, then less charged with inhabitants, and had established there that system of laws which has so long been the glory and protection of that country. He concluded with a passage on the nature of politics and governing. "Let those flatter who fear. It is not an American art. To give praise which is not due might be well from the venal, but would ill beseem those who are asserting the rights of human nature. Open your breast, sire, to liberal and expanded thought. Let not the name of George III be a blot in the page of history. The whole art of government